I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, in 1846, the United States sent the Yankee army across the Nueces River, the border, to invade Mexico. 2 years later, Mexico City was occupied by the American forces, and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed, which forced Mexico to surrender half of its territory over to the U.S. It was a controversial war at its time and remains one even today. The basis for the conflict was trumped up in a thinly veiled land grab fueled by manifest destiny and white supremacy. Today, the Mexican-American War gets little attention. Why are there no massive memorials to that war? But there are myths on both sides of the battle lines about that conflict that still exist and still influence how the two nations see each other now. We speak with Peter Gardino, author of The Dead March, A History of the Mexican-American War. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. When the cannon smoke cleared from the 1846 American invasion of Mexico, the U.S. gained the territory that now includes the states of New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, California, western Colorado, and Texas. This was a war that changed America, both in size and composition, but also in the nation's psychological makeup. This was a war that was started to take land from Mexico, and because that is an inconvenient and uncomfortable fact, this is a war that is often not celebrated or examined. But historian Peter Gardino says that's changing. Gardino is a professor of history at Indiana University. His book is The Dead March, A History of the Mexican-American War.
I believe the war is substantially underrated. Most American history books kind of slide over this war. They head kind of directly to the Civil War. Even when they look at it, they look at it mostly as a kind of prelude to the Civil War. And it's important for that reason also. But it was a war that really shaped the United States. It definitely shaped Mexico in very important ways. And we the United States would not be what it is, both good and bad, without this war having occurred.
This was the first American war on foreign soil. This was a war, we hear it in the Marine hymn, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. It's part of the American tradition. It set the mold, set the course for gunboat diplomacy and other things of great aggressive American action.
And this is a war that one of the reasons why it doesn't take a more prominent role in American history and the way American history is taught is that many Americans are, to some degree, ashamed of the aggressive nature of this war. It's a war that, although there have been efforts to dress it up as being something other than a war of naked aggression and conquest, that's really what happened. It's almost impossible to avoid that. There is no memorial for this war on the Mall in Washington. It's one of the few ones that doesn't have a war memorial on the Mall or near the Mall. It's pretty clear why that is the case.
Yeah, so then let's talk about how we got to the Mexican-American War. First of all, people are not even really clear on what we're going to call this conflict. Some call it the Mexican-American War. Some call it the U.S.-Mexico War, the American intervention in Mexico. I mean, so when we say Mexican-American War, why did you choose that?
I needed to convey something that was short, obviously. I needed to convey, these different ways in which people call this war. Usually the people who call it the North American intervention or the American intervention are people who are Mexicans, right? And that's mostly, if they either call it that or they call it the War of 47, even though it started in 1846. And on the U.S. side, there's less political conflict over what the war will be called, for various reasons. One of them is that the war is seen, much more negatively in the north of the United States than it was seen in the south of the United States. Many Northerners believe that it was a war to add slave territory. Henry David Thoreau famously refused to pay his taxes and was jailed as a result, and as a result of that experience wrote the famous essay on civil disobedience, which ended up being inspiration for many people in the world, including Martin Luther King. It was a very controversial war.
So what made it controversial? This was a time of manifest destiny. We thought that America had a God-given right to conquer both coasts and take over the entire North American continent.
So the question there is, who's the we who thought that the United States had a God-given right to do this? Because manifest destiny was a controversial concept in its time. There were many Americans who did not believe in this expansionism, or who believed that America should exert more power in the world largely through diplomacy and trade, and not through going out and acquiring more territory, especially not fighting wars to acquire new territory. As it turned out, you know, President Polk had to engage in substantial manipulation of information to get this war started in the first place. You know, once he did, the war had a moment of great popularity very early on, and then it rapidly became less and less popular as time went on, especially as reports came in from the battlefront of American soldiers dying, of American soldiers dying of diseases in camps, of American soldiers committing atrocities against Mexican civilians. It became less and less popular as time went on, and it launched the political career of people like Abraham Lincoln, who was a fierce opponent of this war. So manifest destiny, you know, in the history books now, it often comes off as, well, Americans believed in manifest destiny. But it was a controversial idea. This expansion was controversial. And some people wrote at the time that, hey, if we acquire all of this territory this way, we're going to end up in a civil war. And it turns out they were right.
It goes to another justification for the war and the capture of the territory that eventually became half of the United States, that there really was nothing there. It was only Mexico on a map. Mexico really did not occupy that land. It was basically land in a vacuum.
Well, there was substantial presence of Spanish-speaking Mexicans in many of the territories that were acquired through this war. A very large population in New Mexico, a very large population in California, some in Colorado, some in Arizona, not very much in the way of Nevada. It was relatively thin on the ground because it was difficult to make a living. In the case of California, it was difficult to make a living because California was really isolated. In other words, it had a very nice climate, especially for raising cattle, but it was difficult. Before the Panama Canal, before the railroads, shipping anything from California was a difficult thing, and it was particularly difficult to ship anything to Mexico because of Mexican geography, in which the population sits in the center of the country, the large part of the population away from the coast, and there were no good means of transportation between the coast and where people lived in Mexico. In the case of the rest of what is now the Southwest, it was very dry. So there was cattle ranching was possible and farming was possible in valleys in New Mexico and some places in Texas. But it was very difficult. The population to survive in this arid environment had to be really spread out. Cattle ranches are huge for a reason. It's because you can only raise a few head in any given acre. And that made them very vulnerable to Native American raids, which, in fact, made it extremely difficult to make a living raising cattle in these territories. The fact that it changed after the U.S. conquered it has a lot to do with the reality that the Americans quickly found minerals that made it possible to do things like have a large population in California, and that later on the Americans built railroads that tied these areas into the U.S. economy in ways they were not tied in before. So the notion that this was empty, to some extent, it's much less populated than the areas of the U.S. that were settled in, which basically was up to about Missouri. But there are definitely people who live there, not only the Mexicans, but many Native American groups.
So you say the discovery of minerals in California, and that means, the discovery of gold. We struck gold in 1849. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was wrapped up in 1848. I mean, it's kind of one of the cruel twists of history that after that became official American territory, boom, the gold strike and the 49ers. The 49 is so seminal that we even have an NFL team today named for that event.
And, that's the story that you hear in the U.S. history books. And it's very much a true story that we were very fortunate. The settlement of California would have been much slower if we had not struck gold in California. But it turns out the same thing is true of New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado, that when we began finding minerals there later, in the 1870s and 1880s in most cases, but We found the minerals that fueled the American industrial economy of the late 19th century, large amounts of silver, large amounts of copper, and made possible, you know, in these old West movies where you see these mining towns, that all is on territory that had belonged to Mexico before. So the, you know, the history of the U.S., we tend to see Manifest Destiny as, oh, it's settlers, right? Oh, they're going out and farming these areas that they've acquired from the Native Americans or they've acquired from the Mexicans. Well, that's part of the story, but more of the story is about mining, and especially mining by big business interests and the late 19th century.
Here we are. We're looking at Manifest Destiny and that as a driver of events and as history today. But at the time, they were looking at it as an aspirational force. Was it really seen as fate, or was it just words?
Well, it depends on who was doing the talking. As I mentioned, it was controversial. Many people in the U.S. believed that the U.S. should be pretty much the eastern seaborne, the eastern part of the South, and what is now the Midwest, that spreading out so much was going to make the United States weaker over the long term. They were particularly concerned about the spread of slavery into any possible new territories. But then there were people who were equally passionate about the notion that the U.S. should spread from sea to shining sea, to the point where they were talking openly about the justice of the war in terms of, well, we should have this territory because we need this territory. But that was very controversial. Senator Thomas Corwin, who's a senator from Ohio, is a member of the Whig Party and an opponent of the war, said at a certain point in a famous speech in the Senate that he had been a lawyer for many years and he had never heard a horse thief plead that he had stolen the horse because he had to have the horse because it was the best horse in the county. Okay, that simply that something being desirable made justified stealing it. In other words, he was extraordinarily controversial. It took a while for Mexicans to really begin to understand how much greed was involved in the United States. Mexico went from seeing in the 1820s the United States as a sort of sister republic, a friendly power that would share the continent with them, to realizing, oh, they believe that we are racially inferior, and we can see by looking at the Native Americans and African Americans what they do to people they think are racially inferior. And as their understanding of this grew, Mexican nationalism became stronger and stronger, and that's one of the reasons why the war lasted as long as it did and why it was as violent and as tragic as it was. Polk had hoped to basically strong-arm Mexico out of this territory without a war or without a major war, and he got a major war, one that ensured that he wasn't going to have a second term as president. One that cost thousands of lives, roughly 13,000 Americans, probably twice that many Mexicans.
This idea of the American character having a white Anglo-Saxon extra ability that would give them right to this property and also was a clear-cut victory in Mexico, and that they saw that as a reflection and as proof of that belief.
So a lot of Americans saw this in a very triumphalist fashion, that this was proof of American superiority, the fact that they had been able to go and defeat Mexico to fight this war very, very far away. Not everyone did, but many of them did. Many others were very disappointed in this war, even some of the people who fought. For some of the soldiers who went to the war, those who had signed up specifically, volunteered specifically for this war after it had started, one of the things that they got was in addition to pay, to salary, was they were promised certificates good for land in the West. Okay, so in other words, they were promising each soldier a little individual piece of Manifest Destiny. What they found when they returned, most of them were funneled through New Orleans on the way back, was that when they got off the ships in New Orleans, they found themselves surrounded by hordes of speculators who spoke to them about these certificates for land and said, listen, it's going to be really hard for you to take this promise on a piece of paper and go all the way to Washington and get it validated and actually get any land. And we'll buy it from you. We'll buy your certificate from you. And they were selling these things for basically pennies on the dollar, being cheated out of the things that they had been promised, the things that they had in mind as they watched their fellow soldiers die, as they themselves suffered the violence of the war and the disease of the war. And many of these volunteers were extremely bitter about this.
Many people did not just assume that the United States was going to win this war. It was the first time that the United States was going to invade another country, and that the Mexican army, on paper, had a large standing army, and they were fighting to a war of defense, and which probably would have weighed in their favor. Why was it that the United States was able to win this war in 2 years?
The principal reason the U.S. was able to win this war was the United States was a much wealthier country than Mexico. Per capita income in the United States was about three times what it was in Mexico. The United States industrial development had already really started. The Erie Canal had really kick-started development in the Midwest. The U.S. had these waterways that were terrific, running up the Mississippi and on the Ohio and the Erie Canal and a lot of navigable rivers on the East Coast. And so they had this large unified economy that was extremely productive. If you look at what goes on in Mexico during this war, first of all, Mexico, despite being a very large country, was only populated in certain areas because most of it didn't get much in the way of rainfall. So generally speaking, people, even the agriculture relied on seasonal rains. There were no navigable rivers because the rains were mostly seasonal and the terrain is very steep. And so their economy was just much worse off from the beginning. And when you look at the experience of Mexican soldiers, you begin to really understand this, because they were constantly able to raise new armies. Every time they lost a battle, they were able to raise new armies. It was not hard to get people into the army to fight the United States. That was relatively easy. The hard part was feeding them once they were there, equipping them with modern weapons, giving them the gunpowder things, having the food for the horses that they needed in order to be able to travel, but especially feeding them. The experience of Mexican soldiers was dominated by little hunger all the time. So when you can't feed them, eventually you can't keep these armies together because people are compelled to eat, and they start to drift away from their units, spreading out through the countryside trying to find something to eat. So when Mexican generals made mistakes, it was difficult to recover because they usually were, we have food for up to this moment. We have to win the battle at this moment. We don't have the choice of fighting another day when conditions are more advantageous for us. While the Americans were able they had enormous wealth, better weapons, and above all, the ability to keep their soldiers fed on foreign soil through 2 years of fighting. And that was due to the strength of the American economy.
You say the Mexican generals made mistakes. It seemed like they made a lot of mistakes, maybe because the stakes were so high and they had so few resources that those mistakes were magnified. But not challenging Winfield Scott's landing in Veracruz, that seemed like a terrible mistake.
Well, the problem there was that there was a lot of possible beaches he could come ashore on, and there were very few Mexican soldiers in Veracruz, fewer than 4,000. There were enough men basically to man the walls of Veracruz, although they also didn't have enough to eat. And there was no way to know ahead of time where Scott was actually going to come ashore. Okay, so, and moving, even if you could see, where the American ships went to, which is just a few miles from Veracruz, to move the quantity of soldiers through the deep sand dunes, along the beaches to get them in a position to try to block where the landing was, the Americans on water were much more mobile than the Mexican forces. So it was just too big a gamble to take with the forces that this Mexican commander had at his disposal. What he believed was if he could hold out long enough, that a relief force would arrive from the highlands where most Mexicans actually live. And it was on the way. Okay. What he didn't calculate was the reality that once Scott was ashore and once he'd landed his troops and landed his heavy guns, that he would decide not to besiege Veracruz, but instead to bombard it. And the bombardment was deliberately aimed to force the hand of the Mexican commander by killing Mexican civilians. And Winfield Scott was very open about this in his memoirs. He said very openly, I had the choice of waiting And if I waited, the relief force would arrive, but especially yellow fever would start to kill my troops. Okay, or I could attack Mexican civilians and force this guy's hand. And he said, "Well, I chose, you know, to protect the lives of my soldiers and the success of my campaign at the expense of Mexican civilian lives." This surprised the Mexican commander. He didn't think anyone would do that. Okay. And once it started happening, his hand was forced. After a few days of bombardment, they surrendered Veracruz to protect the civilians.
And then Scott marched towards Mexico City and came in contact with General Santa Anna.
So the next major conflict in that campaign was at a place called Cerro Gordo, in which Santa Anna had blocked Scott's path. He had been able to, with immense difficulty, gather a force of Mexican soldiers, have some food available for them. Some of those soldiers had marched from far northern Mexico in a very brief period of time, which astonished American officers when they realized that it had happened. They were always astonished by the ability of Mexican soldiers to march very quickly on very little food. They were often admiring of Mexican soldiers, it turns out. And then what happened at Cerro Gordo is that Scott was able to outmaneuver Santa Ana or Cerro Gordo by going through terrain and especially bringing cannon through terrain, very steep terrain that was covered with all kinds of brush and bushes, and get to the flank of Santa Ana and behind him. And that's what sort of won the day for the Americans. I've walked over these places, and even today, when there's a lot less vegetation than there was then, it's really difficult to walk around in the hot sun. He could do this. Scott could do this because his soldiers were well rested. They had plenty to eat. They could pull off what was really a physical feat that was really astonishing, and that astonished Santa Anna when he found out they had done it.
We're talking about the Mexican-American War with historian Peter Gardino on The Source. A quick break. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. This is a pre-recorded program, no calls or emails today. We're speaking with Peter Gardino, author of The Dead March, A History of the Mexican-American War. So old fuss and feathers, Scott had plenty of motivation to win the war, but what about the average soldier? What was he fighting for?
It depends on which kind of average soldier. And in fact, this book is mostly focused on common people, including average soldiers and average civilians in both countries, much more than it is focused on the decisions of Santa Anna or Scott. And in the U.S. Army, there were basically two kinds of men. There were men in the regular army, most of whom had joined the regular army during peacetime. They'd mostly joined in eastern cities. Many of them were German and Irish immigrants. They were the poorest of the poor. When you look at what they say about when they joined the army, they often talk about how they were hungry and they had no other choices, and so they joined the army. And once they were in the army, they were in for a long time. They were long-serving soldiers. They had 5-year contracts. They were disciplined and trained together, and most of them fought from the, first of all, fear of their officer. They would be punished if they did not fight, but also love of their comrades. In fact, when you look at what they had to say, they talk about, well, we had our pride in our unit, and we loved our comrades, and we didn't run away because we were worried about what the man next to us would think, not because we were worried about what the officer would think. The second kind of soldiers were these volunteer people in these volunteer units that were raised specifically for the war, and they were the ones that often, from the Great Mississippi Watershed, a few from the East Coast, especially the southern part of the East Coast, and they were the ones who really bought into Manifest Destiny. They had been subject to quite a lot of propaganda about the inferiority of Mexicans. Propaganda that really got started with the Texas Revolution, about how Catholicism made Mexico particularly inferior. Many of them were very, very anti-Catholic. They were the ones who actually were promised land if they went through with this, if they served. And they were given to very overt demonstrations of patriotism. They liked to celebrate American holidays when they were in Mexico. They were great admirers of Andrew Jackson and of George Washington. They saw themselves as kind of the heirs of the people who'd fought for independence and the heirs of people who'd fought in the War of 1812 with Andrew Jackson. So their motivations were really quite different. The regulars saw the volunteers as being very unprofessional. They didn't take care of their appearance. They didn't keep their camps orderly. They died much more often of disease because they didn't take care of sanitation in their camps the way the regulars did. They made fun of the volunteers for sometimes not behaving correctly in battle, sometimes running away and ducking when they shouldn't have been ducking, things like that. the volunteers looked at the regulars as being essentially kind of slaves. By signing these five-year contracts, they've given away their freedom for 5 years. That's not something Americans would do. The regulars were subject to very severe corporal punishment, floggings, and even worse punishments. The volunteers thought, and they were not manly because they agreed to be subject to these things in order to be in the Army.
Was there any thought that they were liberating Mexico?
Some people, especially among the volunteers, believed that they were liberating Mexico, that they were going to bring a kind of freedom to Mexico, that the Mexicans would come around to their point of view, that especially if they could import Protestantism to Mexico, that Mexico would become more like the United States. They liked to write this, especially early in their time in Mexico. As time went on, many of them came to understand that even when Mexicans talked to them or welcomed them into their homes, the Mexicans didn't really like them. They were just particularly hospitable, right? A very strong culture of hospitality that actually many of these Mexicans who might come to their camps and sell them things, for instance, were actually collecting intelligence for the Mexican army and for Mexican guerrillas as they were doing it. And they came to see Mexicans as being untrustworthy, as they talk openly about, well, they'll talk to you and have a smile on their face, but they're really looking for a chance to stab you in the back.
You talk about the Catholicism prejudices that the United States had at the time, and they were deep. But we had this legend of the St. Patrick's Brigades, so Irish immigrants who were basically taken right off the boats and put into the military. Were there great defections of Irish soldiers into the Mexican armies because of a common Catholic bond?
So there were many, many soldiers from the regulars who deserted in Mexico. There was a tradition of regulars deserting even before the war. These people joined the army often right off the boats, like you said, because they couldn't really make a living. Got to New York and said it was really hard to make a living, and the army offered you a roof over your head and clothing and food. And what they found in the army is they found a lot of anti-Catholic prejudice on the part of the officers who were almost exclusively Protestants. They found this very fierce corporal punishment, and some of them felt that immigrants were singled out for a lot of this corporal punishment. They were punished unfairly. So many of these men, when they got a chance, even before the war, they would desert, especially from units that were posted in the West. They would desert. And this continued during the war. What the Mexicans initially promised these men was, if you desert, you can become a civilian in Mexico. And most of them tried to become civilians in Mexico. What they found was that in this relatively unproductive economy, it was very difficult to make a living, okay, extremely difficult. And over time, others came to accept the offer that, well, one of the ways you could make a living was as a professional soldier in the Mexican army. So Catholicism was part of it. They definitely felt more welcome in Mexico, where Catholicism was a very large part of national identity and priests were all over the place. But a lot of it was simply being able to make a living. And toward the end, some of the ones, as the Americans closed in on Mexico City, there were many of these deserters from the American army who had been living in Mexico City, and they got caught in this double bind. The government no longer gave them money because the Mexican government was out of money. They couldn't go out and look for work in Mexico City because when they did, they still had their American uniforms on. They were blonde or relatively light-skinned. They had American uniforms on, and they found that the Mexican civilians were more and more riled up against the Americans as they came closer and closer. They expressed their nationalism by looking at these foreigners walking around and not understanding that they were people who had left the American army. You know, they taunted them, they abused them, in some cases they killed them. And so the Mexican army, joining the Mexican army for some of these people in the St. Patrick's Battalion was the last choice that they had. At least if we join the army, that we're going to be safe from Mexican civilians and we'll fight. So some of them were definitely ideologically motivated. They had a flag that was actually an Irish shamrock on it. Some of them were religiously motivated, and some of them were just people caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. And in a lot of ways, their story is very tragic. You get people of all kinds in the St. Patrick's Battalion. But the most important thing to realize is that it's a couple of hundred people at any given moment, while thousands of American deserters were actually in Mexico trying to make it as civilians. So only a few ended up in the Mexican army.
When we come back from the break, how fake news about the Texas-Mexico border moving it from the Nueces to the Rio Grande, started the Mexican-American War. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. This is a pre-recorded program, no calls or emails today. In the 1840s, the United States wanted more land. Mexico had land. The United States picked a fight and started a war and took Mexico's land. It's a story told in the book, The Dead March, The History of the Mexican-American War. The author is Peter Gardino.
In leading up to the war, a lot of this has to do with Texas. Texas joining the United States and the question about where the border between Texas and Mexico it was at the time, and whether or not it was at the Nueces River or at the Rio Grande. And so it was President Polk who drove the line that it was the Rio Grande, and that was, what, a provocation to begin the war?
That was very much a provocation to begin the war. That was the lever he was going to use to try to force the Mexicans to give up New Mexico, Arizona, and California. Ironically, the American officers and the army led by Zachary Taylor that were ordered to march into that territory, they all understood that they were marching into Mexico. They marched into it as if they were marching into enemy territory. Zachary Taylor's principal aide, a man named Ethan Allen Hitchcock, wrote in his diary that when they sent a map from Washington showing that the Rio Grande was the boundary, people said, that's not right. They saw that as a very cynical political maneuver on the part of Polk, one that they might pay for with their lives. They were not necessarily happy about this, but they did what they felt was their duty, which was to obey the orders from Washington. This intermediary strip between the two rivers was a strip that for many years had not been part of the province of Texas when Texas was part of Mexico. For the first few years after Texas independence, Mexican officials had been there collecting taxes and enforcing laws. Texas had done nothing about that, had not been able to do anything about that. But in the intervening years between 1835, 1836, and the war in 1846, what had happened is that Comanches had come to dominate that area and had driven most of the Mexicans out. When the American army marched in, they found burned ranches. Ironically, the Comanches were able to do that because they had a huge market for the livestock they stole from the Mexicans, mostly horses but some cattle, in the burgeoning U.S. economy. They had a market for their goods. They could sell these things to traders in places like Oklahoma and take the money and buy better guns than the Mexicans had. And so they had driven the Mexicans out of this sort of border strip. And you know, Taylor was ordered to go in and take that and deliberately ordered to take that and defy the Mexicans to do something about it. When they started to do something about it, the first skirmishes of the war started, and those were the ones that Polk used. That one skirmish in particular was the one that Polk used to argue that, in his words, American blood had been shed on American soil.
But it was not American soil.
It was not American soil, and the first really popular, famous speech that Abraham Lincoln gave in Congress, which was about a year later, he said, literally shouted, "Show me the spot where this happened. Show me the spot on the map where this happened," because it wasn't on American soil. And for years, he was known as Spotty Lincoln for saying that. It was very definitely not American soil. And not even the American soldiers who died in that skirmish thought that they were on American soil. And that's the irony of the situation. The other irony is that Polk believed that Mexicans were very inferior, that their government was very divided and very fractious, and that Mexicans were racially inferior, and that maybe they wouldn't give him all this territory further west, California, New Mexico, Arizona, without any war, but that any war would be a very short war. A skirmish or two. And what he found was the opposite, that he had to launch a major invasion of Mexico, of northern Mexico, that even when that invasion was largely successful, the Mexicans refused to negotiate about California, Arizona, and New Mexico, that therefore he had to launch Scott's invasion, amphibious invasion through Veracruz and go all the way to Mexico City, that thousands of American soldiers were in the end going to die in this war, And Scott was totally taken by surprise by how much the Mexicans defended their territory and their territorial sovereignty, how many Mexicans, even very poor Mexicans, were willing to put their money on the line, their little money on the line, and their lives on the line, to argue that, yes, we are Mexicans. Yes, we are not going to be pushed out of this territory.
Chapultepec Castle kind of capsulizes that attitude. They were willing to fight to the last man. It was basically their Alamo, I guess, is a comparison. They lost the battle. They won the moral victory.
So by then, we're talking months later, and the Americans have managed to get all the way to the Valley of Mexico and are fighting to approach Mexico City. And Chapultepec Castle, although it's called a castle, it was actually kind of a mansion. It had been built during the colonial times as a place for the viceroy to actually live, a nice place on a height overlooking the city. It's not a very high height, but it is a height. And then later on, it had become the military academy for Mexico. Most of the defenders of the castle were sort of common Mexican soldiers, but some of the cadets had asked to be allowed to stay and help defend it. And what the Americans did, after having lost many men in kind of frontal attacks earlier in the campaign, they decided this time they were going to use heavy artillery to take this mansion, which was not really a military fortification, and bust it up. They bombarded it for a whole day and a whole night before they assaulted it. And they destroyed whatever defenses the Mexicans had, and then they pushed many troops into assault. But you still had this very vivid scene in which the little knots of Mexican soldiers would make stands and try to keep them from advancing and die there, including some of the cadets, until the Americans pushed their way all the way into the mansion and into the big patio at the center of the mansion. And at that point, the Americans, and this often happened in 19th century military assaults, they so many of them had died on the slopes that they just kept killing Mexicans even when they tried to just surrender or run away. They didn't slaughter any of the cadets that way, because one of the ways in which you could get a promotion in the Mexican and in the American army was by capturing an officer, and the cadets had officer uniforms on. The cadets that tried to surrender were actually allowed to surrender, but many Mexican common soldiers were not even allowed to surrender at that point. There's a legend that some of the cadets wrapped themselves in the Mexican flag and threw themselves from the heights of this castle rather than surrender. That didn't really happen. What's true is that several cadets died defending this position.
The Niños Héroes of Mexico, I believe you that it didn't happen, but there are plenty of people in Mexico that say that it did.
So this is a classic historical problem. There's two ways you know it didn't happen. First of all, you can find the first times in which it's mentioned as happening, and it turns out to be 30 years after the war. Okay. Secondly, if you actually look at the eyewitness accounts of American soldiers, of Mexican officers, there's no mention of this whatsoever. There's not a single eyewitness account of anyone wrapping themselves in the flag and throwing themselves off. And there's not even any contemporary accounts until decades after the war that you begin to get people saying that this happened. And when they do, it's when they're starting to commemorate this war and starting to use this war as a sort of symbol of Mexican nationalism, which is something they really weren't doing immediately after they lost the war, because they were upset about losing the war.
After the victory and the United States is occupying Mexico City, what did we have? What was the situation as we gained control of Mexico City?
The situation was very difficult, because any place that we garrisoned, we controlled. Any place that we didn't garrison was dominated by Mexican guerrillas, who continued to fight for many months after the U.S. took Mexico City. What did happen after a few months was they began negotiations with the Mexican government, which literally had nothing left financially. And so when you look at the Mexican side, the congresspeople would say, well, yeah, we can raise more armies, but we can't feed them, and so it's useless to raise more armies. Well, that's when they began to realize they were going to have to actually give up this territory in order to get the Americans out of Mexico. Even then, these negotiators fought for the rights of the Mexicans who lived in those territories. They tried to get provisions into the treaty, and they were in the draft of the treaty that was sent to the American Congress that protected the rights of these people, the rights of people to hang on to their land, and especially the rights of people to hang on to their religion. But in this anti-Catholic United States Congress that had to the Senate had to ratify this treaty, they took all that language out, almost all the language about land and all the language about religion, about specific protections for Catholicism. They took that language out. So they ended up with none of that, which led to various things in the history of the American Southwest later on. The American soldiers in this occupying territory had this sort of strange experience where they had a lot of money and people were willing to sell them things. But they lived in fear of their lives because if they went out drinking after dark, especially in Mexico City, they were likely to get knifed. The sort of clandestine war in the streets of Mexico City continued for months after we took control of the city. So it was not the most comfortable experience, especially because American soldiers continued to die also from disease during all of this time.
The United States had control of Mexico, and there were people who wanted manifest destiny. Why didn't we take the entire nation?
So there were two reasons. One was that the people on the ground in Mexico City, the American officers on the ground, were writing home and saying, it is not possible to continue to control this territory. We only control what we're standing on. For us to try to keep this forever means we have to keep a very large army here, even to control what we're standing on. Any government that we put in place in Mexico is only going to be sustained by American bayonets. In other words, they were worried that the American regular officers, including Scott, were worried that this would be endless if we tried to annex all of Mexico. But simultaneously, and this is very ironic, there were many American politicians who did not want to annex all of Mexico precisely because they thought Mexicans were too racially inferior to be assimilated. Mexico had a very large population. It was mostly of mixed Native American and white and African American descent. Many American politicians, especially Southern politicians, believed that trying to assimilate this population would put whites in America at a disadvantage. And for this reason, they shot down any efforts by other politicians to say that they should keep all of Mexico.
But Mexico is America's neighbor. We share a border. Was there any concern that there was going to be long-term, multi-generational resentment and hostility between the two countries?
You know, I've never read anything by anyone that suggested they were looking that far ahead. And I think the biggest reason they were not looking that far ahead is they didn't believe Mexico was ever going to be powerful enough to do anything to the United States. And to this day, it's a very unequal relationship. I mean, the U.S. tries to impose policies on Mexico. Mexico sometimes tries to influence the U.S., especially on things like trade and immigration, but rarely actually gets much influence. American politicians feel perfectly comfortable continuing a kind of racism, which they deliberately associate Mexicans with crime and disorder and drugs. They even launched presidential campaigns saying that. I'm not going to name names. There's very little that Mexican politicians can do about this. Mostly because Mexico still remains economically substantially weaker than the United States.
How is the Mexican-American War remembered in Mexico? The answer when we return after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. The U.S.-Mexico War isn't a war that gets a lot of attention in American grade school history books, but in Mexico, it's a different story. Peter Gardino wrote the book, The Dead March, A History of the Mexican-American War.
They remember it very well. It's actually had an increasing presence in Mexican memory over about the last 20 years. For many years, they tended to try to avoid it. They tended to try to play up historical events, including violent historical events, that could be spun more positively. A few years after that, the French had invaded Mexico, and Mexico had triumphed against the French. So that got a lot more play in Mexican history books. And then the revolution got a lot of play in Mexican history books because it could also be spun as a kind of triumph for the Mexican people in the end. You know, but then in the late 90s, there was the 150th anniversary of the war, and you began to get sort of more attention to the war. But also what's happened sort of more recently is that as tensions between your average Mexican and the United States have grown, as a result largely of immigration policy, but to some degree of trade policy, you know, people are looking more and more to this war as evidence that, well, you know, the Americans, they're not necessarily to be trusted. They still have these highly racialized views about who we are, you know, views that we could be traced right to the 1830s and 1840s. And so you do see sort of more consciousness of this.
Did you come across any sort of resentment from questions? People were asking you, why are you digging this up? Shouldn't we just not really look at this war too closely?
Not really. Not even when I was in archives on Mexican military bases, on the major Mexican military base in Mexico City, the military archive is there. People always treated me with great courtesy. I've been going back and forth to Mexico and researching Mexican history, often in very out-of-the-way rural places for about 30 years now, more than 30 years. And I've always been treated really extremely well. It's one of the reasons I keep going back.
I'm wondering about Americans giving you a hard time.
Americans don't either, partially because a lot of them are curious about this war, especially people interested in military history. But you know, there's substantial curiosity about this war today and consciousness of its importance today. I mean, there are some Americans who kind of glorify this war. There is an organization of descendants of Mexican War veterans that has their own little journal, and they have a website. They continue to espouse the view of the war that's kind of Polk's view of the war. That this was a war that was necessary to defend American honor. This was a war that helped make America great. It's not my job to make people happy. It's my job to engage them and help them see the past and to see it as in a manner that's as clear-eyed as possible. And you know, I expect to catch some flack, not terribly worried about it.
Yeah, you shouldn't be, but the past isn't always the past. We bring it back all the time into the now. There is a interesting cemetery in Mexico City of soldiers who died. It's a national cemetery, 1 acre right there in the middle of Mexico City. That is the tomb for many of these soldiers that died there.
So I've been there. It is a very small plot of land. It came into being a few years after the war when American veterans, realizing that many of their Americans who died in the battles around Mexico City, that their graves had been essentially lost, they went back to the places where they were buried and they exhumed these bodies that were mostly in common graves and moved them to this one location. And it's mostly one single large common grave, and then there's a kind of niches around the end where other Americans, some veterans of the war, some who were not veterans of the war, were buried there later. But most of the war, people died in the war in one large common grave there. And there's a little museum there. If you go there in a you know winter afternoon, you'll find there's the gates open. It's kind of hard to find. It's not near any major public transit. But there's a very nice gardener there who opens the gate, and you can wander around. It's a very sad place, not because it's a cemetery, but because it's a cemetery that specifically exists because of the violence that happened that shortened so many of these people's lives. One of the things that happens when you're writing a book like this is you go many, many places, you know, cemeteries and battlefields and things like that, and it's hard not to be sad when you write about something like this.
But it exists, and it's essentially forgotten.
It's essentially forgotten. If you go...
I've been there. They have a Memorial Day ceremony there every year, and I've attended. So it's a sad event, and you feel the history.
You definitely feel the history.
Peter Gardino is a professor of history at Indiana University. His book is The Dead March, A History of the Mexican-American War. It's published by Harvard University Press. I'm David Martin Davies. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.